My guest is Jonathan Powell. Jonathan Powell is the founder and CEO of Intermediate, a registered charity for negotiation and mediation, and was Tony Blair's chief of staff throughout Blair's 10-year premiership, 1997 to 2007. Welcome to the podcast, Jonathan.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Right, well, actually, welcome back. We last had on these podcast chats, could you imagine, back in 2017? So it's about time we had another one of these things. You are much in demand, Jonathan, as you always are, but particularly in the run-up to the British general election in July, to give people insights into how Number 10 works from your experience. I kept away from you then because there were too many people knocking on your door, but now, 4 months later, some of the dust has settled, and of course, some of the personalities have changed. I don't want to spend too much time on that part of the story, but I would like you to start, if you wouldn't mind, giving us a picture of what it's actually physically like inside Number 10. We know it's not the White House and not even the West Wing. What is it like as a place to work in terms of its physical layout?
Well, so physically, Downing Street is a completely inappropriate place to be an office or the office of the head of government. It's like a little country house in the middle of London. And when I came in 97, I suggested we should move out into an open plan office, somewhere like the QE2 Centre, where we could just sort of spread out across the building. But you can never do it because everyone wants to come through that front door, 10 Downing Street. So you end up with people working in bathrooms and corridors. It's like a sort of hospital on a bad day, and it doesn't really help the work ethic or approach in Downing Street. But everyone wants to be in there. Increasingly, people are now in the Cabinet Office and come through the green baize door, which makes life a bit easier. As in, yes, Prime Minister, that green baize door used to have a key, and that restricted the numbers. Now it's just a pass, electronic pass that gets you through, so it's easier to do that. But it is a very strange place to work, including for the Prime Minister. We started with Tony in a very small little office, which was the old Marcia Forkender office. It was extremely depressing because it was north facing, and Tony's quite addicted to sunlight. And it had no way of controlling who went in and out. There was no one outside. It's a terrible decision. After about a year, we changed it, and he moved into the Private Secretary's office. And since then, the Prime Ministers have always stayed in that office. But it's a difficult place to work in itself. It's quite small. It's the smallest office, really, of any of the great offices of state in the UK. And the other thing that people need to bear in mind is quite how brutal the transition from opposition to government is in Britain. It's unique from that point of view. In the United States, you have 3 months between the election and actually coming to power, time to prepare, choose your staff, draft your legislative program, and so on. In Britain, you have people who are exhausted by election campaign, exhausted by staying up all night at their election count, who come in the next morning, not just have to appoint a cabinet after they've kissed hands with the king, they also have to draft the Queen's speech or King's speech nowadays because it's on vellum. So it has to be printed 3 days before it's delivered. So you have to have your whole legislative program ready and a whole program of announcements, etc. So it's incredibly difficult to do, and I have great sympathy for anyone trying to do it.
But doesn't this inside the building, in this kind of enforced intimacy in effect, at least help in internal communication? People bumping into each other all the time, getting a coffee from the kitchen corner, wherever it is, the water cooler. Doesn't that help internal communication?
It doesn't really, because everyone's in their own little room. It's not somewhere you don't have water coolers, etc. In fact, when we went in, there wasn't even a canteen. One of my most successful innovations was to bring a canteen into Downing Street. So it's difficult for people to gather. There are no sort of meeting rooms as such. And when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, people didn't go in the corridors. So at least in our time, people would be in the corridors and meet each other. I remember going in a few times when Gordon was Prime Minister. It was very hushed in the corridors. Gordon, in fact, moved down to the old Whip's office in number 11, hang on, no, number 12 Downing Street, right down the end towards the park, because he could have an open plan office there and have all his key people around him, which was a sensible thing to do, I think, although he mainly worked in a small office. But people don't really have the sense of how cramped, restricted, and divisive Number 10 is, because people are on different floors. So if you want someone who's working on a policy issue to come see the Prime Minister, you've got to allow time to get the message to them, get them to come down and join in, which is why everyone wants to sit right outside the Prime Minister's office so they can influence him, whenever he comes out of that door.
I want to spend quite a lot of time talking about the role of the chief of staff and what the position is in reality, as well as this kind of textbook definition. But before that, Jonathan, it is slightly confusing to the outside world, people who aren't, obsessed by Westminster politics. Some of the titles in the structure of government, as far as the Prime Minister's office is concerned. So there's a principal private secretary, there's a parliamentary private secretary, there's the cabinet secretary, there are other titles like head of political strategy and all that kind of stuff, and chief of staff, of course. Could you, before we go on to the chief of staff, which position, which is obviously core to this chat, could you briefly tell us what all the other different titles actually mean in practice?
Yeah, all secretaries none of them could type, as yes points out. So the cabinet secretary is an innovation that goes back to the First World War, known as Hankey. And the idea was to have someone who could coordinate government work, because as government got bigger with the First World War, it was more difficult to use the informal mechanisms of the 19th century to make work come together. And Maurice Hankey stayed for 30 years, I think, doing the job. So it's an important job in terms of knitting together the business of government, the different departments, which otherwise would just work in their own tracks. In recent years, recent decades, it's also become the job of the head of the civil service, which used to be a sort of different job. So they're also the top civil servant, and they're supposed to offer leadership to the civil service to set the sort of rules on promotion and in and out and so on, and do all the ethics of government, sort of judge if a minister has misbehaved. So cabinet secretary is a big job and requires the right sort of person to do it. The principal private secretary in Number 10 Downing Street is the senior official, senior civil servant in Downing
Right.
Street. They stay when the Prime Minister changes. They're usually from the Treasury, not always. The current one isn't from the Treasury, for example. And they're supposed to make sure that Number 10 sends letters to the right departments, interacts with the departments in an official sort of way. So that's their job. And then you have had for a while under the Tories over the last 14 years also a permanent secretary in Downing Street. So you had a principal private secretary and a permanent secretary, and they were often competing. That was first introduced actually by my former colleague Jeremy Hayward, now sadly
Right.
dead, who didn't want to come back as principal private secretary, something he'd already done, so he came back as permanent secretary. It basically came to the same thing. Parliamentary private secretary is a different thing. The parliamentary secretary is the one who accompanies the Prime Minister in the House of Commons, is his eyes and ears in the House of Commons, sits behind him at question time. But all those other secretaries are all permanent civil servants.
Right. So, in the chief of staff, maybe briefly the formal role as you can find in some academic textbook, and then more importantly, the reality of being a chief of staff to the Prime Minister.
Well, I invented the job in the UK because I spent a long time in the United States. I'd also observe, because my brother worked for Mrs. Thatcher for 8 years and then for John Major briefly, that the problem in Downing Street was everyone was competing. There was no one person under the Prime Minister who could resolve conflicts, who could decide what advice went forward and so on. Everyone would, on a Friday evening, there'd be an unseemly competition to be the last person to put a note into the Prime Minister's box for the weekend. And so I thought you needed someone like the American system who can take decisions below the Prime Minister, so trivial decisions don't need to go to him, who can coordinate between the political part of Downing Street and the civil service part of Downing Street, the foreign affairs part and the domestic part, the press part and the policy part, and so on. So we created the job, and I did it for 10 years in Downing Street, and it's stayed ever since. And I don't think it'll go away. Or pretty much all the other presidents and prime ministers now have chiefs of staff, and I think they always will. The job is done in slightly different ways by different people and different prime ministers, but I think the job will carry on because that coordination function is essential.
What are the key the key powers, to use slightly dramatic language, of a chief of staff, especially from your experience as a chief of staff?
Well, formally speaking, a chief of staff doesn't actually have any powers because they're not covered by any legislation or statute or so on. So one of the controversies we got into when I was doing the job was Robin Butler, the cabinet secretary at the time, wanted to introduce an order in council to allow me and Alistair Campbell, who was our press secretary, to tell civil servants what to do. As Robin has accepted later, that was actually completely unnecessary because special advisors, these temporary civil servants who come in with political leaders, have been telling civil servants what to do for decades. So it was actually unnecessary. So there's no definition of a chief of staff. It is simply the power is simply the reflected power of the prime minister. So you have a constituency of one, which is the prime minister. What you do when you say the prime minister wants, you have to actually carry credibility that he really does want that you really are talking for him. So the closeness of the chief of staff to the prime minister is his or her power. There isn't any other way of getting power.
And the closest, does that mean also being, in effect, the gatekeeper that people like you would actually block or determine who would get access to the prime minister?
I the thing about gatekeeper, I always find slightly. I guess it is true because everyone thinks they should see the prime minister, and unfortunately, there's enough time for everyone to see the prime minister. So, good part of the job of the diary secretary, the person who sits closest to the prime minister by the door, is to say yes or no, and that in the end relates to the chief of staff because the chief of staff is the diary secretary's boss, so they get to say yes or no. On the whole, I mean, there are exceptions to this. So, in the American system under Nixon, with Ehrlichman and Haldeman, that was a problem. They really brought in this really tight system, and they restricted access to Nixon. To no one could go to see him apart from through them, and they were very restrictive of who allowed them to. And it's crucial for a prime minister, particularly a prime minister as opposed to a president, to stay in touch, to be talking to. Tony was very good. He'd call up his mother-in-law. He'd call a farmer he knew in the Lake District, so he'd get different points of view. Otherwise, you're very, very restricted by the channels of information to you. So yes, you have to do scheduling, and scheduling is crucially important. The most powerful person in the White House is the scheduler, and the same is true in a parliamentary system like ours. But on the whole, they're not using it to frustrate people or to exercise power themselves. They're just trying to manage the very limited resource of Prime Minister's time in accordance with his priorities.
Is there a temptation of cheaper stuff, or even it goes to the job to micromanage the feeling that you have to be on top of every single little detail of every single thing, which leads inevitably to kind of blockages in the system? Or did you learn quite early on to at least delegate certain aspects of your job?
Again, as I say, it's done differently by different people. And if you are by nature a sort of control freak, you will try and control everything. And that means there's delay in decisions. I like to think I wasn't too bad. I was pretty useless at delegating, but I was pretty good at letting decisions go through without insisting that I had to opine on every one. So we never had real log jams of decision making. But it is something that so any chief of staff needs to be self-aware about. You need to avoid catastrophic mistakes, and you need to so you do need to look at the whole range of things. But if you slow everything down so it doesn't goes to a snail's pace, you're really going to be frustrating government.
Well, let's bring it now to the current day. And we're going to talk about obviously what's happened the past few months. It'd be stupid not to. When Keir Starmer initially announced the appointment of Sue Gray as his potentially future chief of staff in the event of election victory, what kind of reaction did you have? Good idea, bad idea, indifferent?
It was a very good idea to have a civil servant as chief of staff. Tony Blair had chosen me as his chief of staff in opposition to show that he was, in part, to show he was serious about government. Traditionally, chiefs of staff, which had existed in opposition, Charles Clarke was Neil Kinnock's chief of staff. There'd been political fixers. There'd been people with a political background who did that sort of job. Tony decided to go a different route and wanted someone who was civil servant to send a signal. Now, I was a very young, very junior diplomat, not in a domestic civil servant. Sue was a very senior home civil servant. So I think that sent a very good signal about what Keir Starmer wanted to do in government. And it clearly produced some greater discipline and order in the office of the leader of the opposition. So at least to start with, I think that was a success.
Right. But of course, the job is now held by Morgan McSweeney. We all know that, hardly a scoop. His previous job before becoming chief of staff was head of political strategy. Was that a job that existed in your day?
It wasn't a job, but it was something that was exercised by a number of people, like Peter Mandelson, like Alastair Campbell, and like late Philip Gould. So we actually had a team doing political strategy rather than one person. There wasn't an official job. But remember, Morgan McSweeney also had been chief of staff before that to Keir Starmer in opposition. So it's a job he'd done previously in opposition as well as now in government.
I knew you wouldn't dream of giving advice to anybody, especially the new chief of staff of the prime minister. But what kind of things do you think that Morgan McSweeney should pay particular attention to as he's in the very first part of this brand new job, which he's never held before, obviously?
Well, as I say, the job can be done in different ways. What I think Morgan McSweeney will bring to the job, which is really essential, is a political sense of direction. What you can get in Downing Street is you can, and in ministries actually, is what like Gerald Kaufman used to call ministerialitis. You can sort of become convinced that you become a minister by an act of God rather than by winning an election. And therefore, you can just carry on doing what you want. And actually, you have to think about the politics because the power of a prime minister, funnily enough, is very limited. People think he's got a huge amount of power. But actually, the power is all exercised by persuasion. You have to, because the prime minister has almost no civil servants, almost no money to spend. So he has to persuade his health secretary or his chancellor to do certain things. And that comes from political strength. And that in turn comes from having a clear political strategy of where you're going. So I would advise to focus on, I think, what Morgan's particular strength is, which is the political perspective. That's really necessary to make this work and to see where the gaps are, where he's going to have less experience, like making the government machine work. And I think there's already signs clearly that he's doing that. He's bringing in people who have the capacity to do other things like strategic communications. And I think that's the right approach. That's the approach I would adopt if I was in that place.
Right, well, let's move on then and move on and zoom out to the outside world, if you like, outside Downing Street, and maybe close to your current activities, which is post-Brexit in particular, Britain's place in the world, Britain's role in the world, Britain's ambition in the world to be a player in this post-Brexit world. What is, as we move on, it's hard to believe, well over 8 years since Brexit. If you were to analyse now Britain's position on the world stage, as it were, to use that phrase, how would you describe it in a few words?
Well, describing one word, which is largely irrelevant, two words, largely irrelevant. I work around the world on conflicts, and I'm sorry to say that in most places I go, no one asks me what's the attitude of the British government. What's the British government going to do? The impact of Brexit was to sort of take us off the world stage almost. It's like when you have a really big meal, and all the blood goes to your stomach, and you're no longer sort of looking out. You're no longer everything's focused inwards, and that's what happened because of Brexit. First, the fight over Brexit. The mess we made of the negotiations and the legislation and everything else. And then afterwards, the argument inside the Tory party about whether they'd actually implemented Brexit in the way the Brexit ultras wanted. So we just decided we weren't playing in foreign policy. I mean, I exaggerate a bit, but that was what it felt like to me as I go around the world. Now, there are some exceptions like Ukraine, where the UK under Boris Johnson opted for a public position on Ukraine, where we were the champions of Ukraine, where we were the hardest of hardliners saying fight to the death. But actually, we didn't. I mean, we provided quite a lot of assistance, but we didn't actually provide anything like as much assistance as Germany or the United States. So we slightly overdid our rhetorical performance relative to our practical performance. But on most issues around the world, we were marginalized. And I think that's one of the challenges that Keir Starmer is going to face. How do you make the UK relevant again, make it count again on the world stage, because it's important to us. It's not just for fun we want to have influence. It's because we want to have some leverage on what Britain's on our future. Otherwise, we're just a cork bobbing around on a wave and we'll end up somewhere. We want to actually be steering and paddling so we go where we want to go.
Well, before moving on to what Keir Starmer can or should do as Prime Minister, let me try and sort of make a counter case. As we've left the European Union, but we're still key players in the G7, we're a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, key player in NATO, and so on and so on. So it's not as if our influence has diminished overnight as a consequence of Brexit.
Well, I think the tricky words you've used just there, key player. We all the assets we or many of the assets we had, we still have with NATO, UN Security Council, a good diplomatic service, global reach, the English language. All those things are still there. The problem is we haven't been using them for the last 10 years or so to our advantage, to our for the purposes they were designed. So the question is, how do you actually activate that again? We haven't been thrown out of those things, so we have the chance to do it. And we're still a major economic power. It's just we've been looking inwards, and now we need to look outwards and see if we can find a way of making those relative advantages we have advantages again.
What kind of progress do you think has Keir Starmer and his Foreign Secretary David Lammy and other, obviously other players in the cabinet made since their election in July, or to repair some of this reputation, if you like, to reassert our influence on the world stage? What have they done so far that meets with your approval?
I had to worry about my approval, but I think there is something that happens almost automatically after you've had a long period of quasi-isolationist government in place. I remember when we came in 97 after the beef war, how pleased our European partners were to see a leader who was going to cooperate with them and work with them. I remember going to see Chancellor Kohl in the Chancery in Bonn, and we all stood outside in a queue to shake him by the hand. And he came up to me and shook me warmly by the hand and said, "Oh, the good pal, not the bad pal," because my brother had worked for Mrs. Thatcher and written the Bruges speech. So I think this government has had some of that, both from European governments and elsewhere, and including Washington. They're pleased to have a government that is more internationalist, that is not going to break international law as a habit, is not going to renege on its word at the drop of a hat. So I think that's a natural advantage they've had from the beginning. Then I think they've sensibly reached out to Europe. They've made it clear they can't rejoin the EU at this stage. That's just not on the cards for Britain because of the public attitudes, which wants to go back in at some stage, but is not ready to reopen the wounds of Brexit at this stage. So I think building really close relationships with Europe is key. And I think that the fencing was announced the other day with Germany, I think, is very important. I think some of the other, they're going to Brussels and seeing Ursula von der Leyen, going to the other capitals, engaging with the Europeans, I think that's really quite important. I think Nick Thomas-Simmons has played a behind the scenes an important role in trying to do that. So that's certainly what I would have done. And I think that's what they have done. Now, take a bit of time for that to demonstrate results, but I think that's important. Of course, in terms of transatlantic relations, obviously they've managed to rebuild relations with Biden, which have been fractured a bit by their approach to the Northern Ireland peace process, perhaps more widely. And they've also tried to reach out to Trump, but that's going to be a problem for all world leaders. If Trump were to win the election, they're all going to be struggling to engage with President Trump, which is one of the reasons why it's important to have good relations with Europe when that happens. So I don't think, I mean, I think it's very early days, so it's hard to judge how far they've achieve that, but that, as far as I can see, they're taking many of, or most of the right steps that need to be taken.
You say it's early days, and it is early days, objectively speaking. Some observers, not just critics, impartial observers, and some fans of the UK saying a lot of this is all very well. You're coming to see us more frequently than we Europeans. You're smiling more and you're engaging. But at the end of the day, when it comes to substance, there's not an awful lot there to speak of. It's slightly performative. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, you do hear that quite a bit. Although, funny enough, you don't hear it so much, I think, at the top of the organisation from Ursula von der Leyen and some of the others. I think you. It will, in the end, depend on what we're prepared to do. If it is just going to be what the Rishi Sunak government was doing with a smile, that's not going to work. You know, it's not obvious why the Europeans would want to engage if that was the case. I think, in terms of defence and security, particularly with a change of US administration, many Europeans think it's important to engage with the UK, and I think the UK thinks it's important to engage with them. So I think that's kind of a key, if you like. Everyone agrees on that. It's how you go wider than that. What can you do about youth exchanges? What can you do about the trade without having the three freedoms and all the rest of it? So was it four freedoms? I also forget how many freedoms there are.
At least four, yeah.
At least four. Yeah, I mean, I can understand the skepticism. And I think it will depend on whether the government's able to demonstrate that there is some beef there, if beef is the right term to use, not to be. But if we can get into some of the harder issues in terms of, for example, defence procurement, you know, how easy is that going to be to do? And that's why I think the German thing was quite good from that point of view. So I think, again, we'll be able to judge that in a year or two's time. Whether the skeptics were right or whether people who are giving them a chance to start with and finding ways to cooperate are better judges.
Right. Okay. A final question then. We've agreed, or we've heard from the same sources that there's no immediate prospect of any rejoining the European Union. What kind of things do you think we could do concretely? Do you think the government has a strategy, absent any kind of rejoining the EU, rejoining the single market, customs union, etc., a free movement in Europe? Any kind of strategy about engaging with Europe, which is not just kind of tactical and ad hoc?
I'm not in the government, so I don't know for sure, but I've always been actually quite impressed by Nick Thomas-Simmons. He's very quiet, he's operating behind the scenes, but I think he has a plan along with Keir Starmer, and he's trying to advance on it. How far he can get, there are constraints politically in Britain on what you can do. Because I always see the glass half full rather than half empty, I think I'm hoping there is a plan. I'm hoping it's a sensible plan that will convince the skeptics that we're serious. It does seem sensible to start on the security widely writ part of the agenda, because that's the threat, because of the war in Ukraine, because of the threat of China, because of crime and all the rest of it. So if we can start, because remember, the Tories were holding back on this stuff, saying, oh, this is a big plus for us helping Europe on this, and therefore we should demand things in return. I don't think that's right at all. It's in both of our interests. So I think that's a sensible place to start. Well, then it will get increasingly more difficult when you go beyond that. And that's, I think, where the rubber will hit the road, and we'll be able to judge better in a year or two's time.
Okay. Well, we have to leave it there. Jonathan Powell, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. Pleasure talking to you.